And what do such buyers usually do? Said Johnny.
Oh, it all depends. Ordinarily, they would pay cash or use their credit to pay for the auctioned planet. Such buyers usually have credit or other collateral, and they assume the balance of the mortgage. They often just move in, but if there is local protest, they get a short-term loan from the bank and engage in a swift military suppression of the population. Sometimes they sell the original population as slaves to meet their payments. Such buyers want to move in their own people, you know.
Johnny sat and looked at them. I don't think a buyer would find it so easy to take this planet.
Oh, said Dries, brushing it away. The planet has no defenses worth mentioning. You have very few people. Modern arms could do it in a few days. This combined force you had here was just a buzzing of insects. The real fleets of those combatants weren't even involved. But be calm. There is no reason to become alarmed. It is just business. Just a matter of a mortgage and paying one's obligations. A banking matter.
So you are waiting now to see whether we win so you can serve that paper, said Johnny.
Oh, I think you will win, said Dries. That is why we are talking with you tonight. We want you to arrange a meeting with your government the moment we know it really has one. And then we can serve this paper and discuss things. That's all.
If I'm going to arrange a meeting for you, said Johnny, you had better show me the paper so I will know what I'm talking about.
I'm not serving this on you, said Dries, but you can look it over.
Johnny took it. It had pages and pages of legal details tracing the discovery, the loan, the payments made. And then it had a huge single page attached to it. Johnny had held each page of it up to catch the light better, and to expose it to the button camera that had been going in the upper corner of the room all evening, and he now held up the final one. It said, Notice of Delinquency. 2 blank, legal owners and occupiers of planet at time of service. Date, blank. You are hereby summoned to a meeting with the duly appointed officials of the Galactic Bank to A. discuss terms for the discharge of this pressing financial obligation forthwith, well understanding that it is overdue by 1 year and days, without any payment of any kind and without any arrangements to extend or discharge. B. If such arrangements are found unsatisfactory by the Galactic Bank, to surrender title, occupancy, and use promptly to avoid further penalties within 1 week from above date. The undischarged amount of said loan and mortgage being 40,960,217,605,216 galactic credits, being the unpaid remainder and interest of the initial loan, advanced in good faith to the Intergalactic Mining Company of Cyclo, of 60 trillion galactic credits, and paid by Galactic Bank transfer at the order of said Intergalactic Mining Company to the account of the Imperial Government of Cyclo, being in full payment for purchase of said planet Earth, Solar System, Universe 16. Signed and sealed, Dries Glotten, Branch Manager. The Galactic Bank, Baylor, Batafor System, Head Offices of Sector 4, Universe 16. Johnny said, And what would be satisfactory terms for its discharge?
Oh, said Dries Glotten easily. A payment of 5 trillion at once and some arrangement like 500 billion a month would do. You see, legally, a whole loan becomes due and payable instantly if payments are missed. So you will really find the bank very easy to do business with, for we could require the whole amount instanter. We really are your friends, you know. We always pride ourselves not just on our total honesty and integrity, but on our customer relations.
5 trillion, thought Johnny. 500 billion a month? They only had 2,200,000,000. They had no industry or income. No resources they could dig out of the ground would match the amount needed in that time period. Dries saw through his fairly well-hidden consternation.
You'd have a whole week. It is very liberal.
And as soon as this conference decides the fate of Schleim, said Johnny, and the relationship to the other combatants,
Why, the planet will have a clear title, said Dryce triumphantly, and you can arrange the meeting for us, and we can serve this paper and the whole thing will be handled.
The winning government, said Lord Voraz, would have days to discuss it and find where they were going to get the money.
You couldn't lend it to us, said Johnny.
Oh, dear, no. It's already been lent.
And who might buy this planet? Said Johnny.
Why, any one of the combatants would be glad to have it. They, unlike you here, have industry and credit and collateral.
So, after we win this war, if we win it, then we might lose it totally, even to the Tallneps, said Johnny. Well, said Dryce Glotton with an expressive hand gesture, banking is banking. Business is business. 6.
Stormont folded across a desk in the ops room, jolted out of the sleep of exhaustion. Groggy from days of directing battle, it was with alarm that he saw Johnny. Wake up, Johnny was saying urgently. He was trying to shake the Buddhist communicator, Tinny, into some sign of life.
What's the matter? Stormalong surged up. Have they started attacking again?
Worse, said Johnny. These small gray men. Tinny, please wake up. The woman was almost senseless after days of combat communication, all without sleep. Johnny had bowed the guests out. He had walked a full circle around the night-shrouded bowl. McAdam. He knew he had to get hold of McAdam at the Earth Planetary Bank in Luxembourg and get hold of him fast. He would arrange no meeting with the government. But he sure would arrange one with somebody who should know banking. Tinny was coming awake. McAdam, said Johnny. Get McAdam on the radio.
What's up? Said Stormalong.
Johnny was usually pretty cool and calm.
What can I do?
Johnny shoved a pair of discs at him, the recordings of the whole party. Get me duplicates of these. It's a dinner party. It made no sense at all to Stormalong, but he went over to the disc duplicator and ran them off. Tinny was trying to wake up Luxembourg, sleepily singing out the code call signs in Pali.
If you're calling Luxembourg, said Stormalong, they're all gone.
Then he realized Johnny had not had much briefing.
It's Russia, said Stormalong.
The Singapore people got there, and they can't get near the place. It's all on fire. Johnny didn't understand. An underground base on fire?
You've been there, said Stormalong. I don't know why, but they had some material, some black stuff, inflammable, outside the main entrances. Do you know what it was?
Coal. The Russian base had been piling coal up for the winter.
It's coal, said Johnny. A black rock that burns. Well, whoever built that base built it next to or on or under a mine of this stuff, and in the fighting it must have ignited. The Singapore team couldn't get near the base. They were very few, and they didn't have any mine pumps, and even if they had, there was no water near there. They yelled for help. They had to get the fire out to get near the base. Luxembourg was the only defense area that was never hit, and they had flying tankers there. About 2 hours ago, they filled those tankers and flew to Russia. We have no further reports on the fate of the Russian base, and there's no defense team left in Luxembourg.
Surely the Earth Planetary Bank had a radio, said Johnny.
Yes, said Stormalong doubtfully, but at this hour of the night, I don't think it would be manned. They're not part of the defense network.
I've got to go then, said Johnny. What planes are left?
Whoa, said Stormalong. I had direct orders from Sir Robert that you stay here.
But McAdam can't fly down here if there are no pilots. Not even one pilot left in Luxembourg?
Not one.
Johnny felt desperate.
Then how about detaching a pilot from Edinburgh and getting...
Not a chance, said Stormalong.
They arrive there, and it's a screaming mess. The whole tunnel network under the rock has collapsed. You can't get into the place to see whether there's anyone still alive in the shelters. They've got atmosphere hoses and equipment to get air in to any survivors, and they're bringing mine diggers up from Cornwall. But they need the pilots they have as machine operators. I don't think I could persuade even one of them.
Do you have a plane here?
Of course I've got a plane here. I've got 5 planes here, but you are not leaving. The woman turned from the mic.
It is dead. There is no one answering from the Luxembourg mine site or the bank. And after all, it is 2 in the morning there.
I'm going, said Johnny. You're not, shouted Stormalong. Then you are, shouted Johnny. Stormalong blinked. After all, he had had about 2 hours' worth of catnaps. You'll have to handle everything here by yourself, he said. Be in the air and at that mic at the same time if you have to fly defense. I'd take Tinny and handle the network from the plane, said Johnny, if I had to go up and fight. But that isn't where the fight is. It's right down here with these small gray men. Can you stay awake to Luxembourg? Stormalong shrugged and then nodded. All right, said Johnny. You take those copies you made of the dinner party and you fly to Luxembourg and find McAdam. Blast him out. Tell him I said it was vital he review those recordings right now, and he's got to find some way to handle a debt. You tell him that. A debt? Said Stormalong. Yes, a debt. And if we don't pay or handle it, we've lost this whole war, even if we win it. Chapter 29 1 The next 2 days were the most horrible in Johnny's life, cage, drone, and all. Stormalong had simply flown into thin air and vanished. He didn't answer on radio even when Johnny said his name in clear. The bank office in Luxembourg was open and answering, but there was just a girl there, and she didn't speak any tongue anyone at Kariba could speak. French? And even though they said McAdam and she tried to tell them something back, they couldn't make it out. Johnny could not leave here. The emissaries in the conference room would go in and out. They were working on and on with the trial. They didn't pay much attention to him. Johnny slept in the ops room and only got out when Chief Chang Wan would spell him for a few minutes by standing in case anything urgent came through. Truth told, there was not too much coming through that Johnny had to handle. Even had he gotten urgent requests, he couldn't have done anything about them, for he had no available pilots, troops, or defense forces. He was actually the only one defending the planet. The woman, Tinny, was lots of help, but there was a limit to the number of hours anyone could stay awake, even a Buddhist nun. Angus was spending some time with the transshipment rig. He had left the gyro cage on a Tolnep mountain to learn the full fate of the moon Asart.
I wanted to see whether there were earthquakes on Tolnep, he told Johnny. When you change mass in a system, you could expect changes in gravitational stresses. I read someplace that if our own moon got knocked out into space or something, it would cause earthquakes here. But Tolnep didn't shake up our gyro cage.
A few hours later, Johnny heard a motor running in the bowl and Edgy had gone out to check. Angus was running a blade scraper. He was pushing a huge piece of the capital ship through the under-cable entrance. It was a piece that had hit the shore. Chief Chang Wan was very sharp with him, for it was scraping up the pavement, and Chief Chang Wan had no men to repair the scars. Angus said something about wanting to see whether the ultimate bomb were still active. "Well, don't bring anything back here that touches that area," said Johnny, and went back in to answer a radio query. The next morning, Angus had come in to eat a bowl of noodles with him and tell him about it.
"I put that scrap metal way out beyond Asart," said Angus. "I thought it would fall through the gas."
"What gas?" said Johnny.
"Oh, Asart just seems to be gas now," said Angus. "Just a huge cloud of gas. It was blackish for a while, but then it cleared up. You can see it as a cloud of gas, but you can see through it. It's pretty obvious now why the cyclos never used that bomb. As mining people, they needed metal, not gas."
"So what happened to the scrap iron?" asked Johnny.
"I thought it would fall through the gas and go on down and hit the surface of Tolnep. It didn't. It fell all right, but it just went to the center of the gas cloud and it's still there. Want to see a picture of it?"
"Just don't fire into that cloud and bring any of that stuff back here on recoil," said Johnny.
"Oh, I won't," promised Angus. "But what I believe is, once that ultimate bomb converted everything to gas, it went null. It doesn't have anything to work on, and the reaction isn't self-starting again once it's complete. The metal trace says that it's all very low-order gases now. Hydrogen.
Then the ultimate bomb brings about low-order fission, said Johnny. It stimulates a split of the atoms of heavier metals. I'm no expert, but that's what it seems you're describing.
Anyway, said Angus, all I'm trying to tell you is that the mass of the moon didn't change so far as gravitic influence is concerned. In that coldness, the resulting gas has kind of gone liquid, and the moon is a sort of bubble with a much bigger diameter. I think you could fly through it.
Great, said Johnny. Don't. Angus finished up his noodles.
I just thought you'd like to know that destroying that moon won't upset our coordinate tables. A shift of mass could throw every coordinate out eventually.
Ah, said Johnny, you do have a point. That was clever of you. Angus thought so too. But news from other areas was not so encouraging. It was not that anything bad was adding up. It was just the non-existence of news so far as the fate of Chrissy and the people in Scotland was concerned, and the fate of his people in the Russian base. They had found the chief of Clan Fergus outside, very close to death, and after emergency transfusions had rushed him up to the old underground hospital in Aberdeen. There was not much hope. They had drilled holes through the rubble that blocked the tunnels, and they hoped they had gotten air hoses into the shelters. There were rumors they had heard voices, but there had been no mine radios in those shelter areas to begin with, and you couldn't tell much while trying to shout down an air hose, pumps running and all. The city was just towers of smoke, as was Castle Rock. They were having a terrible time trying to open the approach tunnels, working around the clock. The Russian base news was not much better. They had put the surface coal fires out, but the mine was burning underground, and they did not know whether it was reaching the actual levels of the base. The huge doors were so warped they could not be opened even with burning torches, and they were now driving in a brand new entrance to bypass them, adrift through solid rock, working over ground that was still burning under them down deep. The ventilator shafts were too tortuous and too barred with armor and filter to be of any use. To add to the tension in Kariba, the original small gray man, Dries Glotten, had vanished. The one anti-aircraft gunner on duty said that the man had simply come out about dawn, ordered a new set of signal lights and radio beacon signals near where his ship was parked, and sailed off, wham, into the sky, and they couldn't even track where he had gone to. The lights were out there now, two reds flashing, and the radio beacon was telling all ships to stay clear from a conference area. Lord Voraz, when asked, had shrugged and said it probably came under the heading of prerogatives of a branch manager, and was probably bank business, and he had gone on eating the perpetual bites between meals the cook served him up. He was no help. But what gave Johnny a shock in those 2 days was the sudden arrival of Captain Rogo Dieter Snell. The conference had called him in as a witness, and they didn't tell Johnny and didn't tell the anti-aircraft gunner. The first Johnny knew of it was the anti-aircraft gun going off. Lord Dom came rolling into operations like a liquid jellyfish, roaring and rumbling to cease fire. Johnny got the gunner to quit. Fortunately, it had been at very extreme range, and Angus had not been using the rig. But Rogo Dieter Snell, omitting to ask permission to land a small launch craft, almost got himself shot down.
"He's been called as a witness," shouted Lord Dom. "Don't you know there's a trial going on?"
Trial or no trial, Johnny stuck a Smith & Wesson with thermite bullets in his belt and plugs in his ears and went out to personally con the launch craft down with a hand radio and make sure the Tallnep remained blind to their defenselessness. Suppressing an urge to shoot Rogo Dieter on sight, he limited himself to confiscating his vision filter, making sure the Tallnep had no spare, and personally escorting him to the conference room. He left the Tallnep there, but told them that when they were through with him, they better call ops to escort him out because Rogo Dieter was going to be stone blind all the time he was around Kariba. About 5 hours later, they did call him again, and he collected Rogo Dieter and guided him out to the launch craft. But before he gave him back the filter faceplate, he had Chief Chong Wan smear the inside of the launchcraft dome with black water ink. Whether Rogo Dieter complained or not, that he would have to wipe holes in it somehow to find his orbiting ship was unknown to Johnny. He still had his earplugs in. Johnny gave Rogo Dieter back the filter for his eyes, and from the look of his mouth, the Tallnep, staring at him, said,
"You."
So Johnny said, "Me." And just as a personal goodbye, the next time I see you on this planet's surface, you won't like it at all. So get the hell out of here. And slammed the canopy down on him. When the launch craft was gone, Johnny took the earplugs out and found that the single anti-aircraft gunner had been begging him for 10 minutes for permission to accidentally shoot the ship down. Johnny sympathized with him. He felt the same way himself. And still not a whisper from Stormalong, and not a bit of sense from Luxembourg. No word of Chrissy, no word of his village people, no word of his friends. It was a horrible 2 days. Inaction, he was finding, was a far, far heavier load than the whirlwind existence to which he was accustomed. He was nearing a breaking point of apprehension for the people and planet he had fought so long to save. At 8 that night, it didn't make things any better to be stopped by Lord Voraz, who offered him a job at 50,000 credits a year to come to the Gradides system and make teleportation consoles for the bank for the rest of his life. Johnny had to walk away quickly to keep from becoming violent. A very horrible 2 days. 2. Things began to change the following day. Johnny had spent the night in ops and was sprawled over a table when Lord Dom came in to wake him.
"In 2 hours," said Lord Dom, "the trial findings will be read and voted upon."
"I'm not a member of the government," said Johnny.
"We know that," said Lord Dom, "but you are personally concerned and should be present. Reparations will also be announced, so be there."
Ah, reparations. A sudden surge of hope. Would they be enough to cover this debt to the Galactic Bank, or at least enough to make arrangements or first payments or something? Tinny had had as good a night's sleep as one could get in a chair. There was very little traffic. And so Johnny asked Chong Wan to stand in for him and went to get dressed. Mr. Tsung was wearing a little round black satin pillbox cap with a blue button on the top of it, and had not ceased grinning since he had recovered his rank. He bowed and got a bath wheeled in on a mine cart, and generally worked to get Johnny dressed and fed. Then Mr. Tsung picked up a little thin box on a silk neck cord and put it on and whispered at it, and Johnny was startled to hear English coming out of it in a flat, electronic monotone. In response to Johnny's raised eyebrows, using the box, Mr. Tsung explained it was a gift from the small gray man, Dries Glotten, before he had left on a trip. A gift for starting a bank account. It seemed that Mr. Tsung's daughter was painting tigers and birds on big sheets of handmade rice paper and selling them to the emissaries for 50 credits apiece. The Lord said they were primitives and collector's items. And his son-in-law had been making pictures of dragons on round metal plates with a molecular sprayer and selling those to the Lords for 100 credits each. And like a good father, even though he despised merchants and the merchant class, he was taking care of their money for them. Mr. Tsung explained that His Excellency had found the language Court Mandarin Chinese in his library on the ship, and had done the necessary microcopy of it, and, you see this little switch here? That's Mandarin to English in the up position, Mandarin to Cyclo in the middle position, and English to Cyclo in the down position. And didn't it sound funny when it turned English into Chinese tones? But that was not all. It was a voco reader. See this little light on the end? You passed that over Mandarin characters, and it read them aloud in English or Cyclo. And it also read Cyclo and English in Mandarin. So now he couldn't be fooled or led into mistakes by wrongly worded speeches. It ran on body heat, so it didn't need any batteries, and now he could talk straight to Johnny. Of course, he'd still learn the languages himself, for he didn't want to sound so monotone. But wasn't Dries Glotten a nice man? He was glad Mr. Tsung could now talk to him without a coordinator, but all the same it made Johnny feel surrounded by the Galactic Bank. Mr. Tsung put it to work right away.
I am told you are going in to hear the sentence, and that it somehow includes you. Now, since you don't know whether you are going to be found guilty or not, you just sit respectfully and listen. And if they ask you anything, you just bow. You don't answer, just bow. That is how you open the way to demand a new trial.
It was good advice, but it did not do much to calm Johnny's nerves. Chief Chong Wan said the radio was quiet. No, no news of Stormalong, nor Edinburgh, nor Russia. The lords were all assembled. They had rearranged the room. They had a high desk on the platform, and Lord Faljapan was sitting at it. The lords themselves were in orderly rows facing it. Down the side of the room was a line of chairs. Schleim was lying on a mine cart, totally wrapped up in hoist chains, with only his face showing above the links. They had him between the desk and the audience. Lord Dom indicated that Johnny should sit on one of the side chairs where Lord Voraz was sitting. It was obvious to Johnny that they didn't consider him part of their deliberations. The lords didn't even look at him. But at least he wasn't there alongside that minecart with Schleim.
"They have already discussed all this," whispered Lord Voraz to Johnny, "but they have to review and vote on each finding. It's really more of a treaty than a trial. I'm surprised the Earth emissary isn't here. But they can proceed without him right up to the signing."
Lord Faljapan signaled Lord Brow to call the session to order, which he did.
"We have already agreed upon and committed to treaty form," said Faljapan, "the redefinition of the word pirate. I wish to call to your attention, however, that the redefinition can have no bearing on the present findings, for it was passed upon after the incident under trial. Is that correct, my lords?"
They signified that it was.
"Therefore," said Faljapan, "we are basing this trial on existing findings and clauses. Testimony of Captain Rogo-Dieter Snow has been heard and duly entered in the record to the effect that he was ordered to disregard the sanctity of the conference area by the Tallnep then-emissary Schleim. I believe it is the desire of this conference to accept the testimony and evidences of the said Snow, particularly in the light of the fact that he considered he was bound to protect the Tallnep emissary. This absolves Snow. Do you so vote?"
The lords so voted.
"Therefore," said Faljapan, "it is considered established by this conference that the said Tallnep emissary, by name Lord Schleim, did willfully and maliciously order the military forces of Tallnep to attack the conference area. Do you so find?"
They voted unanimously that they so found, and Schleim in his chains hissed and spat.
"It was further witnessed and established," continued Faljapan, "that the said Tallnep emissary did seek to paralyze, shoot, and otherwise injure other emissaries engaged in their lawful and time-honored duties, contrary to specific clauses numbered here but too numerous to read. Is that your finding?"
They definitely so found, and Schleim hissed and spat some more.
"Therefore," said Faljapan, "it is adjudicated by this conference, lawfully assembled, by the power of treaty hereby made among planets, that Tallnep shall hereinafter, for a space of 100 years, be regarded as an outlaw nation. Do you so vote?"
They so voted, and with deep scowls of determination.
"All treaties with the planet and nation of Tallnep are cancelled herewith," said Faljapan. "Do you so vote?"
They so voted.
"All embassies and legations and consulates of the Tallnep planet and nation shall be closed and their diplomats expelled, and for the space of the next 100 years, diplomatic functions in minor matters shall be undertaken by the Hovens embassies, legations, and consulates at usual charges. Do you concur?"
They concurred.
"Since the personal safety of the said Schleim was promised by this conference, and since it guaranteed to return the said Schleim unharmed to his planet, it is the decision of this conference that the said Schleim be deposited naked and in chains in the public slave market of the city of Crete, Tallnep, as an expression of disfavor of this conference. Is this your wish?"
It was their wish. Schleim hissed and spat. Johnny wondered when they were going to get around to reparations. It was a thin hope, but it was a hope. Val Japan was continuing.
Since Talnep had the majority of war vessels, and since its officer was, according to the testimony of Schleim himself earlier in this conference, the senior and commanding officer of the combined force, it is the finding of this conference that the non-Talnep nations, which complemented the combined force, are nationally absolved of the offense, but that, as the presence of their forces poses a continued threat in the skies above this conference, this absolution is dependent on the following conditions. A. That they ensure that the Talnep fleet deposits any and all prisoners taken, unharmed, undamaged, at a spot to be designated by the Earth military commander. B. That they themselves deposit any prisoners they may have taken, unharmed, undamaged, at the same or similar place. C. That they then escort, with the use of any military persuasion necessary, the Talnep fleet back to Talnep. D. That they direct the Talnep fleet to land on the surface of Talnep, it being known to the conference that the Talnep fleet cannot thereafter take off again. And E. That they then return to their respective homelands. The forces mandated by this clause are those of the Bolbods, Hovens, Hockners, Jambet Chows, and Drawkins, and any and all forces retained by them, and any and all forces of any other planet or nation from outside this system. Is it so decreed?
There was some discussion as to whether the emissaries representing those forces should vote or abstain.
I suppose, whispered Voraz, you can designate a deposit place for the prisoners in the absence of other authority.
Yes, Johnny whispered back, but they don't say what we do with any prisoners we may have of theirs.
This isn't a peace treaty, whispered Lord Voraz. This relates to offenses against this conference. I put in a word about Earth prisoners. They're planetary assets, you see. Prisoners you have from the fleet up there would only be mentioned if this were a peace treaty. And I doubt they'd take them back due to possible contamination. You might want to get even through biological warfare. You're covered since they included unharmed and undamaged in the clause.
Assets, thought Johnny. You're just concerned about the value of the property you're trying to repossess. But he didn't say it. He was glad they'd get any Earth prisoners back. They had finally decided the emissaries of other combatants had better vote, for it would look better on the record. The conference was then unanimous.
By conference law, Val Japan then said, mention must be made of personal violence used against a then-emissary, Lord Schleim.
Lord Voraz touched Johnny's knee.
This is you.
One designated as Johnny Goodboy Tyler was seen to throw a cane or scepter at the said Lord Schleim, striking him. It is the wish of this conference to exonerate the said Tyler. Do you so vote?
They voted to do so, and Schleim really spat.
Now comes the nice part, whispered Lord Voraz.
In accordance, said Foul Japan, with Clause 103, which covers services in protecting and saving the lives of conference members, for predetermining the intentions of the said Schleim, and for disarming him so that his attack was to no avail, one designated as Johnny Goodboy Tyler is hereby vested with the Order of the Crimson Sash. Is this the wish of the conference?
There was a spatter of applause, a buzz of comment. Lord Voraz whispered,
the Empress Biaz of the Chatavarians created that order 83,268 years ago when an attendant saved the life of her lover at a conference. Someone tried to assassinate him, and the attendant prevented it, but got a superficial knife slash in the process. Hence, Crimson Sash.
He whisked from his pocket a little book which expanded, and he looked up something.
It entitles you to be addressed as Lord, and it carries with it a pension of 2,000 credits a year. We manage the trust fund for it. I must make a note.
They were still applauding a bit, and Lord Browl indicated Johnny should stand up and bow. Johnny thought sourly he'd put the sash on Windsplitter. He didn't want their honors. He sat down. They sure were taking a long time to get around to reparations.
Ah, here they were.
Valjapan was unreeling a long roll of paper with figures on it.
It has also been found that the dignities of the emissaries and their planets have been offended by the unseemly attack or attempted attack upon them by the said slime. A fine and reparation in the sum of 1 trillion galactic credits is hereby levied upon the planet Tolnep by the Conference.
Valjapan rattled through the papers.
The emissaries who had ships in the skies at the time of this incident are not to be included as recipients in this indemnity because of a witting or unwitting taint of conspiracy. The sum, as already discussed in previous deliberations, shall be allocated to emissaries in accordance with populations they represent.
He rattled off a lot of figures.
Does the conference so agree?
They corrected a couple of calculations. Earth, Johnny whispered to Lord Voraz, is getting almost nothing. Some of these emissaries have populations of hundreds of billions, Lord Voraz whispered back. The Chatavarians have almost 39 trillion beings on their 700 planets. What have you got here? 33,000?
The emissaries accepted the amended figures. Johnny held his breath. Were damages to Earth going to enter in here?
Any and all financial arrangements to be made in accordance with the practices of the Galactic Bank, said Valjapan.
He didn't ask for any agreement on that. Lord Voraz simply nodded.
This concludes our findings, said Valjapan. Is it the wish of this conference that these be scrolled in finished form, as voted, so that they can be signed and attested?
Johnny whispered urgently to Lord Voraz,
Wait. They claimed they burned a lot of cities. There are all sorts of war damages.
I tried to get it in. It would have increased the value of the property,
Lord Voraz whispered back.
But this isn't a peace conference, you know. It's a trial and treaty about offenses to the conference itself.
No reparations for Earth? Johnny felt like jumping up and protesting. If Sir Robert or McAdam had been here...
1 trillion credits fine, whispered Lord Voraz, is stiff. It will crash the whole Tolnep economy. Even if Earth were awarded city damages, Tolnep could never pay them after that huge fine. Be happy about it. You got rid of all the hostile forces.
And got rid of all challenges to a clear title, thought Johnny sourly. Now they were wide open to the bank foreclosure with no real money to meet it. But Valjapan was coming down on Johnny.
Your emissary was not here. This is highly irregular. It does not void or change these findings. But if he is not here to sign them, they will not be valid. Your war will go right on. So you better advise your government to get him here quick. These papers will be ready for signature tomorrow afternoon. Are you going to see he is here?
I'm not a representative... began Johnny.
You have influence, said Valjapan. Use it. We want to finish up here and go home.
You better do as he says, whispered Lord Voraz.
Johnny looked up to see Dries Glotten standing at the door. He'd come back. As Johnny walked out, Dries asked Lord Voraz,
Is the Earth representative coming?
Voraz pointed to Johnny.
Will you get him here?
Dries Glotten asked Johnny. Johnny said he'd try, and Dries and Lord Voraz looked at each other and grinned. He was too disheartened about no reparations for Earth to give much thought to them. 3. A few feet from the door of the conference room, Johnny started to get mad. War. Any one of those lords in there, or their governments... merely had to say the word and their fleets pranced off to bash somebody's head in. And when they'd bashed it in, they could just sail off, tra-la, without a thought of what they'd done to people's homes and lives, and then maybe come back another day to bash some more. Johnny took a walk around the causeway of the bowl. It was a sunny noontime, and the mine entrance and exhaust fans made a gentle breeze as they changed the air. The little children lay in the rifle pits, shaded with bits and pieces of cloth. They followed him with their eyes. The dogs woofed and snuffled at him from the ends of their leashes, and somehow, recognizing him as a friend, wagged their tails. The older children, having fed the younger ones, were sitting cross-legged and eating from bowls. They grinned and nodded as he went by. Johnny thought, why shouldn't these children have a chance? Why couldn't they have a future that was happy and safe? War. What right did cold, impersonal nations have to murder and rampage, to smash and crush and gut their more helpless fellow beings? Call it national policy, call it necessities of state, call it what you will, it still amounted to an action of the insane. Cyclo. What right did Cyclo have striking this planet down? Couldn't they have bought what they wanted? Couldn't they have come in and said, we need metal? We will exchange this or that or technology for it? No, it suited them better to murder and steal it like a thief. He thought about the time before the visitors came, when first they had been free from the oppressive tyrants. The people had been trying to get on with it, had been happy, had been working with a will. And then the visitors came, and with them the bank. Organization might be necessary, but it gave no one the right to create a government that was an inhuman, soulless beast. He thought of Brown Limper and his idiocies in the name of the state. Yet Brown Limper had been almost sensible compared to those lords in there. Johnny looked at the children, and he made up his mind. Whatever happened, there would be no more war. Not anywhere. He had been so engrossed in his thoughts that Chief Chong Wan had to shake his arm to get his attention. The chief was jumping up and down and waving at Johnny to come on, and at last practically pushed him into the ops room. Tinny was beaming. A chatter of Polly was spraying out from around her headphones. She said something into her mic and turned to Johnny.
It's the Scott officer in charge of rescue in Russia, said Tinny. They spotted some green smoke coming from a ventilator in puffs. Somebody inside had gotten the armor off the ducts. They've got mine hoist gear going right this minute, hauling people out.
Minute by minute, the reports came in. Then Tinny turned to Johnny.
It's Colonel Ivan. It's for you. He says, tell Marshal Johnny the valiant Red Army is still at his command.
Johnny was about to reply. He was finding it hard to talk. But Tinny said,
here's another one for Johnny. He wants to hear your voice.
She pushed the headset at Johnny. Security or no security, the voice said, Johnny, it's Tom Smiley Townsend. Johnny couldn't talk. Johnny, the village people are all okay. Everybody is all right, Johnny. Johnny, are you there? Thank God, Johnny forced himself to say. Tell them that for me, Tom. Tell them all, thank God. And he sat down in a chair and wept. He had not realized how worried he had been about them. He had suppressed it with an iron will so that he could work. The reports were still coming in, and after a while he got busy. They wanted to know where to go, and he, in his turn, had the glad news for them of the departure of the enemy and the terms, and shouts and cheers began to leak through from the background of the communicator's voice there. They had 5 wounded pilots and a lot of burn cases, and they wanted help from Scotland. He learned the old underground hospital in Aberdeen had been set up, and he got the badly wounded ones flown through to it, and pried a nurse loose in Aberdeen to be flown back to Tashkent to care for the minor burns and injuries. He had gotten so busy with these problems that he had forgotten all about Sir Robert until Dries Glotten got Chong Wan to remind him of it. Johnny had been avoiding it a bit. They had not yet succeeded at Castle Rock, and he knew that trying to pry Sir Robert loose was going to take some doing. He had even wondered whether he couldn't get Lord Faljapan to put off the signing a day. Sir Robert was going to be a handful. Even so, he put the call out and got busy arranging for all prisoners to be put down at Balmoral Castle about 50 miles to the west of Aberdeen, easily found from the air because of 3 noticeable peaks nearby, because of a river, and because it itself was a prominent ruin. It was only about 50 miles from Aberdeen on a road that was in fair condition, but Thor said he could pick any up in a marine attack plane and get them to the hospital in Aberdeen if they needed it. Johnny gave him some precautions and then went out and got the Hoven emissary, who seemed to be the contact now with the orbiting fleet, and gave him a trace map so he could transmit it to the Hauven commander. They said they could do it this afternoon without waiting for the final signatures. Nobody knew how many prisoners there were, but they'd be flown down in different launch craft. Johnny left it up to them and to Thor in Scotland. Doing all that had given him a pretty distinct impression that things were very hectic around Edinburgh, and he was even less inclined to call Sir Robert. Once more, Dry's Glotten got Chong Wan to push him. Good Lord, those small gray men were anxious to get Sir Robert here. He finally persuaded communicators up there in Scotland to track down Sir Robert, and when he finally got him on the radio, every misgiving he had had was fully justified.
"Come down there,"
Sir Robert had rapped back via communicators. And so far as it could be translated and relayed, he told Johnny off properly. Didn't Johnny know that there were 2,100 people in the various ancient shelters beneath the rock, if they were still alive? That heavy bombs had smashed in every possible entrance? They had gotten atmosphere hoses drilled in here and there, but who could talk through those? The rock cliff's sides had been pulverized and shattered so that every time they got adrift going in, they had landslides. Yes, Dwight was there. Yes, Dwight had gotten tunnel casings from Cornwall and tried to drive them in. Did Johnny think they were all standing around doing nothing? It was all right for Johnny to be sitting around with those la-di-da lords drinking tea. Go right on and drink tea, but let people get on with this. It took Johnny half an hour to impress on Sir Robert that without his signature, the matter of the visitors wouldn't be ended. Finally, with considerable blasphemy that the communicators couldn't handle well in Polly, Sir Robert said he would pry a pilot loose and fly down. Johnny sat back, feeling exhausted. He didn't like to fight with Sir Robert, and he could understand his position completely. His Aunt Ellen was in those closed-off shelters. And Chrissy. It was all he could do to sit here handling things when he felt he should be up there digging with his bare hands if necessary. The small gray man looked very pleased when Chong Wan told him Sir Robert was coming. 4. Out of the night sky from the north, rushing far ahead of its sound, seen at first as just another star, a plane approached Kariba. The anti-aircraft gunner intercom sounded. The plane was friendly and requested permission to land. Johnny went to watch it set down. The door opened and somebody jumped out. The face was a white blur in the night. Johnny peered more closely. Bandages. Somebody with his face totally bandaged. A finger pointed at Johnny's beard.
The very thing!
It was Dunnell Dean. They swatted each other happily. Then Dunnell Dean pushed Johnny back into better light and looked at him.
The very thing. Somebody cut your beard half off, and mine's burned half off. Make an appointment for me with your barber.
Did you get shot down? Said Johnny, looking a little anxiously at the swath of bandages on his face.
No, laddie, don't be insulting, said Dunnell Dean. What Bulbard or Draken or Hawkner could shoot down the ace of all aces? No, Johnny boy, it was helping fight fire. It's not too bad a burn, but you know Dr. Allen. Never happy unless he swaddled you up like an innocent babe.
How is it up there? Said Johnny.
Bad. We got the fire out, but that's all you can say for it. Dwight and Thor are trying to open tunnels, but the rock slides. There's lots of hope, but that's all I can give you. See, did that small gray man come back here? Is that his ship over there?
Was he at Edinburgh?
Oh, that he was. Went all around bothering everybody, asking questions, got in everybody's way. And then he seemed to get what he was looking for and went swooshing up to Aberdeen, almost got himself shot down. He was looking for the king, you know, chief of Clanfergus.
How is he, the chief? Said Johnny.
Well, he's a bleeder. You know, doesn't stop bleeding once he's cut. I'm always telling him to stay out of wars. They're unhealthy. Anyway, we found him outside and rushed him to the Aberdeen Hospital and they gave him transfusions.
This small grey man tried to get in to see him, and of course the Gillies threw him out. But then Dr. Allen got cornered by him. Seems like this guy," he indicated the ship where the lights were flashing, "has been collecting books and libraries all over the place. He pictographs them, and he got Dr. Allen to tell him what was wrong with the chief, and they looked it up in a lot of old man books, and Dr. Allen found there was a compound called vitamin K that made blood coagulate, and they synthesized some, and what do you know? The bleeding stopped. The chief's recovering. What is this small grey man? A doctor?"
"No," said Johnny. "He's the sector branch manager of the Galactic Bank. I'll tell you more later. But he was up there making sure this planet had a government."
"Well, that was a nice thing to do anyway," said Dunnell Dean.
Johnny was glad for the chief, but he sure was beginning to feel surrounded by the bankers. He didn't tell Dunnell Dean they were about to foreclose on them. "You see Storm along?" Dunnell Dean shook his head.
"Let's get Sir Robert. He's dead to the world in the plane."
And Sir Robert really was dead to the world. Singed and gray-faced where his skin wasn't blackened with soot, his hands torn, his clothes in burned rags, Sir Robert looked exactly what he was, an old man who had been going through hell for days without rest. They tried to lift and carry him between them, but the old war chief was a very heavy man, especially when dead weight. They got a mine cart and wheeled him into the hospital. Johnny got the nurse up, and she examined Sir Robert. He was not injured except for his hands. She gave him a shot of B-complex, and he never stirred at the punch of the needle. Mr. Tsung and his family were suddenly up and hovering around, and they ran off to get things organized. Shortly, they were giving Sir Robert a bath and trimming the burned areas in his beard and hair so they looked more even. They soon had him in a bed. He had never opened his eyes. Johnny went back to the hospital where he had left Dunnell Dean and found him sitting in a chair, sound asleep, while the nurse changed his face bandages. The burns were not disfiguring. His beard sure was tattered. Johnny stopped the nurse from putting on fresh bandages and called Mr. Tsung's daughter, who came in with her scissors and neatened the Scot by cutting his beard like Johnny's. Johnny had hoped Dunnell Dean could spell him in ops while he went to look for Stormalong. But Dunnell Dean was really in no condition to do anything but sleep. Johnny turned him over to the Tsung family, and they gave him a bath and put him to bed. It must be hell in Edinburgh. Johnny got on the radio to Russia. They had had several thousand people stuffed into that old base. Smoke or no smoke, some of them must be functional. There were 250 Chinese there from North China. There were the Siberians and the Sherpas. Tinny got some of her own messages in. The rest of the monks and the Buddhist library, the Chinese library and such things were safe. She had to run out and tell Chang Wan and Mr. Tsung. Late at night, it might be, in both Tashkent and Edinburgh, but Johnny started shuffling people. The most vital question now was, where was Stormalong? Where was McAdam? The only thing they ever got out of Luxembourg was a girl saying something that sounded like, "Je ne comprends pas." And that sure didn't spell Stormalong or the Scot banker. Was he going to have to handle this foreclosure thing with no help? 5. The treaty signing, Johnny was told, would be that afternoon. They came, Lord Dom and Dries Glotten, to the ops room. Dries seemed extraordinarily pleased. "I hear," he said, "that the Earth representative arrived last night. Be sure he is at the signing." Johnny glanced at his watch. It was mid-morning. He went to the room where they had put both the old war chief and Dunnell Dean. Dunnell Dean was up and dressed and seemed bright enough for all his bandaged face. Sir Robert was just groggily opening his eyes, so Johnny took Dunnell Dean back to ops. "I want you to take over this post," said Johnny. "I'll stay for the signing, but right after that I'm getting out of here to search for Stormalong." He spent some time genning Dunnell Dean in, and then went back to Sir Robert. The old Scot was as grumpy as a bear.
He was sitting on the edge of the bed with nothing much to cover his bony limbs and eating something Chief Chang Wan had brought him.
"Treaty signing," he grumped between bites. "Waste of time. They'll never keep any treaties. This is a beautiful planet here and they want it. I belong right up in Edinburgh helping dig those poor people out. Oh, you were right, McTyler. They all should have been at Cornwall."
Johnny let him finish his food and then, while he was having some tea, went out and got an atmosphere projector. And although Sir Robert spent much of his time muttering and railing about being absent from Scotland, Johnny briefed him carefully on events and what they could possibly do. When he had finished, he stood back.
"I'm no diplomat," said Sir Robert. "I prove that. And I'm no lawyer and I'm no banker. 'Tis a thin chance, but I'll do what you say."
That was all Johnny wanted. In mid-afternoon, they went to the conference room. Sir Robert was in his regimentals, Johnny in his helmet and black tunic. Nobody paid them much attention. The emissaries had drawn up the treaty Johnny had heard voted, and they had it on a big scroll, laid out in such a way that each emissary could walk up to the table where it lay, sign it, affix his seals, get the signature and pattern or print attested by the bank, and then go back to his seat. It was a sort of parade. Dry's Glotten and Foul Japan were the only ones who stood at the table. Sir Robert sat and fumed about wasting time, but he did so only in a very low voice and only to Johnny. They signed and signed. It took them almost an hour. Earth was the last signature, and Sir Robert went up and put down his name, got a match and melted some wax, and then smashed his big seal ring onto it. Dries drew a bank trace around it and held it up.
"I hereby certify," said Dries, "that the Galactic Bank has attested the authenticity of this Treaty of Kariba, Earth. It is complete. May I suggest that immediate copies of it be transmitted to all ships concerned?"
He spread the treaty out, pulled a small picto tracer from his breast pocket, and scanned it down the scroll. Johnny passed it to Dunaldine and Ops for transmission and copies for themselves and all delegates and the bank. The Lord of the Hovens stood up.
"I have received word that all prisoners were put down at the designated place and signed for by the Earth representative there."
Dries looked at Johnny. Word had come from Thor in mid-morning. There had been 7 pilots, 3 Russian soldiers, 2 Sherpas, and 1 Scot, 13 in all. They had been in fair condition. But since none of these invading ships had the kind of food terrestrials ate, they were suffering badly from starvation, and certainly would have died in months-long space travel. They had been rushed to Aberdeen for intravenous feeding and treatment of minor injuries. Thor had had a row with the Hovan officer in charge of the landing, for one of the pilots remembered another pilot he was sure the Tallnaps had picked up. After sending the first group off, Thor had stood by, and sure enough, the Tallnaps had another pilot, a German. It had taken 2 hours to get him set down. They swore that was all. Thor had then believed them.
"Our officer attests we have the prisoners back," said Johnny. The emissaries who had ships in orbit then passed their orders to their respective commanders. There was a wait. Then Dunaldine came in to report that, according to sightings from Russia, the whole flotilla in orbit had flamed up, gotten into formation around the Tallnap vessels, and left. The phenomena of their getting very big and vanishing had been observed. Radio contact was lost. The whole group went outside, and Angus fired a spitting, naked, and chained slime to the slave market in Creeth. The emissaries came back to the conference room. Footnote. There was a curious aftermath to this treaty. Lord Slime arrived back in Tallnap, used the owners of the Creeth newspaper, the leading Tallnap journal Midnight Fang, who were incensed at the loss of their ace reporter, Arsabogger, to conduct a smear campaign on Captain Rogodeter Snowl, blaming him for the entire disaster, Slime claiming it was Snowl's false testimony, which had brought about Slime's and Tallnap's disgrace. Rogodeter Snow was set upon in the streets of Crete by a mob which bit him to death. A relative of the slain officer, Adjutor Snow, in his turn blamed Lord Schleim for the attack and murder. He and a group of fleet officers waited until Lord Schleim next addressed the government